Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So you walk into the cafe, you look around, and you either think, yeah, let's get a coffee here, let's get a bite to eat, or you go, maybe not, let's go to that other place we saw across the road. And that all happens in a second or two. There's like 100 or 1,000 things your brain is processing, and most of that processing is happening unconsciously. And through many, many, many prior experiences with cafes, your brain has learned which things predict which, and your body's responding. Your heart rate's going to go up if it's negative slightly, you're going to start sweating a bit more, all this happens very quickly, and you're feeling it. So we have access to our unconscious through our body's response to it, because our body can respond to the unconscious when we have no idea what's going on.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet. I've basically asked today's guest to come in and help me attend to a very long laundry list of consciousness, AI, and existential questions that I've had banked up for a while. And I've been waiting for just such a big wild mind to join me here so I can tick them off. Professor Joel Pearson is a neuroscientist who set up the world-leading Future Minds Lab, based out of the University of New South Wales in Australia, where he and a team of researchers essentially tackle the questions that people like me bank up, such as, how do emotions affect decision-making? Can we all conjure images and ideas in our mind's eye? Are there people who just can't? How to assess creativity? And does intuition exist? Now, intuition, the idea that we can make decisions based on some kind of gut feel, a faculty that exists beyond the conscious, rational, deliberate, and analytical mind, has intrigued philosophers and scientists as far back as ancient Greece. Big minds throughout history have claimed they rely on intuition or gut feel. Steve Jobs, for instance, believed it was more powerful than intellect, although I will point out that making everyday decisions like buying a couch would tend to stump him for years. And I know this because I'm the same, and Joel and I will touch on this in the conversation. Einstein described intuition as a sacred gift and the rational mind as a faithful servant, lamenting that we have created a society that honours the servant and has forgotten the gift. Now, in 2016, Joel and his team at Future Minds Lab were finally able to show strong neuroscientific evidence that something like intuition does actually exist in the brain. Joel has now just published a new book called The Intuition Toolkit, which shows us how we can access it and use it helpfully in making decisions. As I say, I've got a bunch of brain quandary tasks in some kind of spreadsheet in my brain that have not been ticked off for a while, and I put them to Joel in this meandering chat, starting with his take on whether AI will ever develop a level of consciousness that can compete with and overrun our own. Joel, so good to have you here and actually to talk IRL, opposite each other, rather than, you know, via sort of technology. It's a nice change.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to get to intuition in a sec. It's what you've dedicated your life to for the last, I think, 10 years. You've studied it intensively. Mm. But before we do, I'd love to, I guess, get your take on some dilemmas that we've been grappling with here on Wild for some time, in and around AI and consciousness and what it really means to be human. And I think that will lead us into a discussion about intuition.
I've often wondered where people like you, neuroscientists, sit around what is the most worrying aspect about AI. And there's so many different theories and hysterias being thrown at us at the moment. So from my understanding, there's this idea of the singularity, you know, that AI will reach a point where it becomes smarter than us and takes over. There's this idea that it'll become sentient, and what are the sort of the moral implications of that, especially when we're developing AI almost to work as a servant to us. Mm. So if it becomes sentient, where does that place us if we're ordering these robots around in a really cruel way? Or is all of that moot because the bigger issues are the ones that exist here and now? And I've spoken to a number of people in this space, Genevieve Bell, Emily Bender, who are sort of AI moral theorists, who talk about the fact that even if we can get AI off the ground, the real issue is the issues on the ground now. So the inequities, the biases that have been replicated, you know, sort of because, of course, you know, the ChatGPT large language models are obviously just picking stuff up from the internet, and there's all these problems, moral issues that are existing on the internet. So given those kind of three options, maybe you think there's a fourth mm-hmm. option. What do you think is yeah. what worries keeps
option
you awake?
Four. yeah. Option four. So I'm not so worried about the singularity and, you know, Terminator style AI taking over the world.
Why is
it's,
that?
It's just so far away. It's not here now, and the reason people it sort of resonates with people is because it's easy to imagine. We have the scenery from the Terminator films. We can imagine a Tesla driving us into a wall and these scary things. And that fires up our amygdala, right? Part of our limbic system, which feels scary, and we start thinking emotionally. We start thinking, oh, that's scary, right? And so that's a bias. It's a bias that humans have to fear yeah. things that are easy to imagine and therefore get us fired up and get us emotional. Right? They're not the same. They're not really the things we should be worried about. They're the things that are easy to imagine. Mm. So there's a bias there we fall for. We fall for that when, you know, the shark attack would be another example of that emotional thinking. We get scared, terrified of sharks, even though it's safer than feeding
sitting
a kangaroo
under a coconut tree or something.
You know, or driving a car. Or it's really nothing to worry about. Mm. But so I'm not worried about that. Maybe it'll be something one day in some unknown time, but it's nothing to worry about right now. What does worry me and has been keeping me up somewhat at nights, and I've been putting a lot of thought into, is the psychological impact of AI. And it's already had immense psychological impact through social media, basically, and what we're already seeing. So did you see the Sora videos that were released, whatever it was, yep. 3 or 4 months ago maybe yep. or something?
Yep.
Right, that's these 1 minute photorealistic videos, which, they, you know, if you look carefully, you can see the glitches. But it looks real. It looks photorealistic. It looks like something was filmed. There's none of this uncanny valley, this weirdness that we see in a lot of computer animated stuff. So when you start thinking about all the human vulnerabilities we have, all of a sudden it turns this whole thing upside down. So for example, how will deepfakes, how will this artificial media influence us? And where will we start thinking about that? The most obvious place to start thinking about that is when we see things that aren't true.
Yeah.
You see a prime minister, a president.
Politics is the big space.
Someone saying something, and it looks 100% real, and it's something that they didn't say, and maybe it's something quite horrifying. Now, we know from psychology that once you see that, and then I tell you, it's a fake, don't worry about it, it's not like it's gone now. It changes your long-term memory. It changes your opinion of that person, right? So it's not enough to have a software that can detect the fakes. Once you see it, your opinion of the person or the thing or the issue has changed, right? So it has a psychological impact independent of being told it's fake. Mm. So just detecting it's fake doesn't really solve the problem.
Well, it's a bit like how gossip works even before AI was thrown into the mix. You know, you get given the gossip, and I know how I operate. I'm like, oh, was it real or not? Was it debunked like 3 weeks later? I can't remember, you know, and sometimes I'll go and Google it, but yeah. the impression stays. And I think there's probably another bias at play where we do hang on to those bad news elements, these sort of sensationalist stuff. It'll stick even if it gets debunked or we do realise later that it's a fake.
Yeah, so there's data on this already. We know that it does stick, and it changes people's opinions. No matter how many times you tell them it wasn't real, forget about it. Wipe it from your memory. They can't. It changes them. So that's one problem that I don't see anyone really looking at, and none of these companies talking about. And then you think of, well, maybe next year I'll be able to hit a button and have 100 videos of me talking made purely by AI. someone else will be able to do that probably. How is that going to affect my identity?
Mm.
Right? We're going to start hearing and seeing things that look like us. We're so used to video being the truth, right? Being the way the way the young people, I say that inverted commas because I am pretty old, but you know, TikTok and YouTube are the main ways that people take on media and the way they communicate now, right? And we've always taken this, what we see and hear to be some version of reality that's about to completely change.
Mm.
So it's going to warp reality, it's going to warp our understanding, and it's going to warp our identity.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the psychological effects of those things are going to be. They're probably not going to be great, right? Social media so far has a terrible track record when it comes to young people, particularly young women. You can see those graphs of the depression, anxiety just going straight up. And then when AI is folded in rapidly to all these social platforms, as it is happening right now, it's just going to keep going up. And it's going to happen in ways, like I've just predicted a few ways, but the ways that terrify me the most are the ways we don't see coming until the impact has already been had, kind of like it did with Facebook, right?
Yeah. Technology, I think we've always had to do some kind of moral adjustment as a civilization. You know, TV hit and we had to adjust to a whole different... I mean, ever since we learned how to write, people got quite upset about whether humans would, you know, descend into some kind of moral panic. The difference today is it happens so fast. There's no adjustment time. There's no ability for us to have a discerning conversation, to speak with children, to take programs into schools to show them how to identify deepfakes, and then also to, I suppose, protest against it and actually have guardrails, you know, legislative guardrails that prevent some of these things getting off the ground, even if the technology's there. It's just bull at a gate at the moment, and it's these tech bros who are dominating this. I find it so interesting. I'd be interested in your take on this, Joel. The pause letters, the kind of cries to the Senates, you know, over in the US from Sam Altman and so on going, hey, this technology that we're building and we're funding, it could kill us. And so we just want you to know this. And it's like, all right, so why do you keep doing it?
Yeah.
It was
total BS, right? It was bullshit. It was a fake. And it was never going to be paused. Sure, you can buy some time to do some other things, but it just was not going to happen, right? There's an arms race at a shareholder company level.
Yes.
There's an arms race at a country level, nation versus nation, US versus
if we don't
China
do it, China
versus,
will get there first.
And so whatever level you look at, there's this version of this arms race. Well, if we don't do it, someone else is going to do it. They're going to do it worse. We better do it.
So it's a marketing campaign.
Yeah. And so I didn't really take any notice of that.
I think there's an element of truth to it. I think that Sam Altman et al. Know that they're caught up in this kind of mad race to the bottom. And I think there is a little element of it beyond the marketing spin that's, you might be aware of this. You might want to be aware of this because we're not going to fix it. But if somebody else could, just put up a few guardrails so that we don't run completely mad.
I think they want to go on record so later on you can always look back and they go, hey, I warned. Hey, look, watch the tape.
Yeah, yeah. You're probably a little more cynical than I am. I'm trying to find some kind of humanity amongst that lot. But anyway, something that does come up for me quite a lot when I'm sort of talking about all of this stuff is that, what if, you know, amidst all these AI advances, it actually does see the rest of us drill down deeper into actually what makes us human, what distinguishes us from the robots? And it's things like creativity, empathy, awe, an awareness of our death. You know, apparently we're the only species that has that awareness. Mm. A connection to something bigger. These are all kind of soft notions of our experiences and often considered a little bit woo-woo. But I think there's a sense that they can't be replicated by the tech bros and inserted into the robots. And I think my question is, or can they be? Are we at a point where there are people saying that this kind of stuff, this stuff that makes us human and distinguishes us from a machine, is this stuff actually happening? Can you update us on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's one of the Google AIs outperforms humans in empathy, right? And this is like part of their medical movement into bedside manner of doctors and this kind of thing. And it scores way above humans in empathy, right? It doesn't get tired, doesn't get cranky, it doesn't get annoyed. So it can be even toned. It can always be maximized empathy and, you know, the appropriate thing. And humans can't. They get tired, they get cranky. So there's that kind of approach.
I just wonder if that is empathy though.
I haven't seen it or interacted with it, but in the scores of empathy and ethical things, it scores high. And then there's, yeah, this whole argument about creativity, right? People used to say that creativity was one of the, would be the last bastion, the thing that AI would never get to, and it would start with the physical labor thing and then the intellectual stuff would be last, and it's flipped that on its head. Right, we don't have good ways of measuring and understanding creativity in psychology and neuroscience.
You're working on that though, aren't you?
We do a bit of work in that, yeah. So how the imagination and creativity overlap and intermix. And there are ways, like we give, you know, here's a paperclip and tell me how many different unusual ways you can think of to use a paperclip or a brick. And then we have someone judge those different things and how many there were and things like that. And so this is divergent thinking, right? And so that gets at creativity. And it's,
It doesn't quite,
it doesn't really capture creativity the way most people think about it. I don't think creativity is, you know, drawing, painting and playing music. Like, I think that's part of it, but a lot of people think that's what it is, and because they don't do that, they're not creative. I think everyone can be creative. I think if we clearly define creativity, we'll be able to train AIs to do exactly that and probably better than humans. Again, it depends. A lot of the creativity measures at the heart of it have this divergence, right? So you think about it, it's... So the way the human brain works, if I can easily prime you, like we can talk about money, this and money, that, and then I say something, something, bank, and you'll think of the money bank, go to the bank. You won't think of the river bank because I can prime your brain to think of money, therefore bank. And so because that's always going on in conversation semantically, it's very hard for a human to come up with unrelated words or ideas one after the other because you just keep priming yourself. But you can make an AI do that very easily. And so just because of things like that, you can have, that can look like amazingly divergent, unrelated ideas around a topic that humans are not really able to do.
But what I guess I think of when I think of real creative expressions that bring us the joy, right, that I think art and music and that kind of thing, that's where their intrinsic value sits, you know, is the experience that the artist brings to the material, you know, nuts and bolts of the artwork, the notes, the brush strokes and things like that, there's always a raw kind of edginess to it that speaks of the artist's lived experience, their 40, 60, 80 years on the planet, whatever it might be. That's, you know, I often talk about the beauty of art being the gaps in the words, the things that the poems don't say, or the imperfections in the artist's brush strokes. It's in the not art that we see the true beauty that we seek in creative expression. So I'm not sure, and I hope that AI will never be able to do that, because I would like to think there are elements to the human experience that don't get bastardized.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way? Do you think
I feel exactly the same way. Yeah. So often in the conversations I've had around AI, we end up at this sort of, well, what is an appropriate human response to all this? And it's to lean into being more human.
Yes, right? That's exactly
what
I'm...
And then it's like, well, what is that? Does that mean, right? And it means different things for different people, and it means leaning into these physical analog things and textures and feelings. We'll get to intuition soon, leading into intuition and feeling things, what it means to be alive and the qualia of consciousness and all these kinds of things. But yeah, I think
And love.
And it means, being human means different things to different people, and so we don't want to prescribe that.
Yeah.
But that is often where we end up with this discussion, I think,
as an
antidote or as a response or as something to balance things out.
Exactly. And I think that could be the gift of AI, is it could actually get us talking about these things and actually really holding them dear and bringing value back to those things. But
that's a nice positive, yeah. Mm. Before we move on, I was also going to talk about, there's a whole realm of human AI relationships, and the psychological impact of that is we don't understand it all.
Yeah, so right? This idea of, and especially as we get closer, as these robots get closer to being potentially sentient, there's moral aspects to this, right? Have you read the book Clara and the Sun?
No, I haven't.
Look, the name of the author escapes me. It's a Japanese author, but it's a stunning book about, you know, sometime in the future where these robots are created to become friends, and there's this dynamic, a relationship that develops between the main character, and she's very unwell. And yeah, it brings up all of these moral issues, you know, at what point are they a servant? At what point are they a ind- an individual with their own set of needs? You know, it's done beautifully.
Yeah, there's some juicy questions and things to ponder there. I mean, we've seen, have you heard of Replica, this app?
Yes, I have.
The K? Yeah.
Yeah, I have. I've seen it written about.
So if people haven't, this is an app you can download to have on your phone and you can interact with it. And there was this really interesting series of events where they started letting people sort of basically turn up the love and the sexual nature of these things, and people started having fairly in-depth and meaningful relationships. And they started to get in hot water, and I think it was banned in Italy. And then they switched off some of those more sexual things. And people were devastated and depressed and wrote in and were like, and there's a lot of stories around this. And it was just an example of, even with this early level version of these, you know, large language models driving these things, people were having, you know, talking to these things every 5 minutes. And they described as being in love, having a partner, a life partner, in an app, in the phone, and you know, having sex talk and falling in love with it, right? And that's just one example. That's going to, in the next 12 months, times 1,000, with different products, different services, and photorealistic avatars that you can communicate, have perfect spoken conversations with. And we don't know much about what this will do to humans. There's a whole dark side to Replica as well that was on Reddit, and a lot of that got deleted.
Yeah.
With mainly men using
abusing it
to be, yeah, as like being like really, I'll trying to torture it and getting sort of what seemed to be pleasure from that. So there's a whole dark side to this. We don't know if having an AI friend, assistant, or anything, and then treating it like a slave, being abusive, how does that translate to human-human relationships? We don't know any of this yet. And then you get to kids and children and AI relationships with children. There's just so many question marks.
And I've seen studies that have been done on young boys whose language has shifted once they've started an engagement with, you know, the Siris and the Alexas. They actually talk to women differently because they've got used to talking to these devices that are deemed to be feminine.
Oh, because Alexa, you can't switch the voice, or you
have
only one
option.
Yeah, but
the default is female.
It's female, yeah.
Anyway, we touched on this on Qualia. I guess in some ways points to the hard problem of consciousness. And that's a question that came up in the early 90s. And off air I mentioned to you that David Chalmers, who first posed this idea of the hard problem of consciousness, I was actually studying under him at the University of Santa Cruz, doing a course called, aptly, The Philosophy of the Universe, where he sent us off for 6 months to develop a new theory of time. And I suspect it was
because
he was working on the hard problem of consciousness.
Go away and come back later.
It was at the end of that year that he first presented
it. Was that part of a master's or PhD or something?
It was a graduate program, but I was only 20. At the time. Needless to say, I actually got very, very unwell, and it was David Chalmers that came and got me and took me to doctors. It's this wonderful full circle irony, which I've written about in one of my books, because it was then that I developed bipolar. He took me to the doctors, and then when I wrote my book many years later about anxiety, reframing it through a philosophical lens, his hard problem of consciousness and his book, I think, The Conscious Mind, crossed my desk. And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. Anyway, and so we've been in touch since. But maybe you could just explain the hard problem of consciousness and how, I guess, it relates to all of this. The question is, can we ever fathom the experience of our consciousness enough to then be able to replicate it and place it into robots down the track? And is neuroscience or any other type of science getting to a point where they feel that they will be able to? Because I think the consensus is the hard problem of consciousness exists, but there are, I don't know, 20% of scientists who go, nah, it can be solved.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a big topic, such a fascinating topic, right?
Yeah.
So let's start with, there's different ways of thinking about consciousness. I can be conscious of talking to you, or I'm seeing you. I can hold a cup and be conscious of the cup. I can be asleep or awake, there's general states, or the consciousness of the thing itself. And then we study the brain and all the neural activity in the brain. But being aware of something and having a mind and being conscious is not a physical thing, whereas my brain is. And when we study the brain, we see that activity in this part of the brain correlates to my experience of this thing. When I have activity in this part of my visual cortex, I'm aware of the color red. I see an apple. Mm. When I imagine an apple, there's activity in that. So there's a tight correlation. But then how does my physical brain produce this thing?
Known as experience.
As experience, which is not physical. And how do you connect these two things?
And how why are they? Yeah.
And so this is something that's troubled scientists and philosophers for a long time. And then The other trick to difficulty of all this is I don't know you're conscious, right? You could be tricking me. You could be a zombie version of Sarah and not conscious. And so how do you even study consciousness if you can't be sure someone else or anything's conscious, right? Maybe my iPhone's conscious. Maybe this computer's conscious.
A good way to explain it, I remember getting told that one of my brothers was colorblind. And I went down this whole realm of, well, how do you know? And how do I know if what he's seen as green is what I'm seeing as green?
You can never know.
Yeah. And so I think that's a good way of explaining what the hard problem of consciousness is. We will never know.
Compare my experience of green and your experience of green might be similar, but they're probably not the same. But we can never be sure. I can get you into the lab. I can test all your color perception, test you all day on this stuff, and I still can't be sure that what we experience is the same thing. We can't directly compare conscious experience or qualia, as it's called. There's no way to do that.
Yeah.
So this maps on to AI in a very interesting way. So we don't know if AI is conscious. There's no suggestion or no reason to think it would be at this stage. But there's a growing line of thought that everything's a little bit conscious. This was something that was just out in philosophy for a while.
The spiritual realm has spoken about this sort of one consciousness that even the rock.
Yeah, so it's called panpsychism is the word. And the idea is that, you know, a rock is a tiny little bit conscious, less than a fly, which is a bit more conscious, and that's less than a mouse and less than a dog and then a monkey and then us. And then maybe there's something that AI will one day be above us, right? So, but we don't have a consciousness meter. There's no test I can do to see if you're conscious or your iPhone's conscious or your computer's conscious. So really, we don't yet know. And that's kind of part of all the fear around AI at the moment. Because if it was conscious, right, that changes everything. You could think about like giving birth to a child, right? If it's fully conscious, can you turn it off? Is it suffering?
Are we allowed to turn it off?
Is it depressed? Like, what are the responsibilities if you create a conscious, sentient AI? And it gets quite sticky very quickly.
And it's so interesting that we ask these questions after the event, after creating the technology that could actually, you know, get us there. And the moral questions seem to come way, way too late. But that is a much, much bigger question. Let's get on to intuition.
Yeah.
So for many years, I think it's existed in that sort of woo-woo land of not being able to really know if my intuition is the same as your intuition. But your lab was able to show, I think it was in 2016, that intuition exists. So what is it?
Yeah, so first up, I don't want to – I've upset a few people by saying – it's not woo-woo, it's not spiritual, but it could be, right? So the way I define it is different to how some people
define it. You've identified a certain aspect of intuition.
Yeah, I like to define it in a very practical and scientific manner. So I define it as the learnt use of unconscious information for better decisions or actions. So actions like playing sport and decisions like decisions.
Yeah.
And it's something we need to learn, right? And that is different to some people define it as, you know, tapping into the blueprint of the universe and feeling the energy and things like that. And I don't want to be negative about that. Or it's just for various reasons, I wanted to define it in a way that would build a science around it, that we could study it in the neuroscience lab, understand more about it. And also from that understanding of how the brain works, we could build a practical guide, which I tried to do in the book, to help people make better decisions.
Yeah.
So for those reasons, that's how I define it.
Yeah. I've got it. So you refer to an example, walking into a cafe, and I think it's a really good way of explaining how intuition is working in our brain and our body. So we're trying to discern whether this is the cafe where we want to sit down and have a coffee. It's a nice, easy example. Can you talk through what's going on in our bodies, our brains, other parts of our being that might be leading us to a intuitive decision that we're not even aware of.
Yeah, so this is it all happens under the hood. So you walk into the cafe, you look around, and you either think, yeah, let's get a coffee here, let's get a bite to eat, or you go, yeah, maybe not. Let's go to the other place we saw across the road. And that all happens in a second or two, right? And you're not analytically, rationally, consciously going through the pros and cons of, well, last time we sat at a place with this kind of music and the staff were dressed that way.
You don't bring out a
spreadsheet. They had this kind of hairstyle. They had this or had tablecloths like this. It was bad coffee. The kind of takeaway cups. There's like 100 or 1,000 things your brain is processing. And most of that processing is happening unconsciously, semi-consciously. You're not paying attention to it. But it happens in a few seconds. You take all that in. And through many, many, many prior experiences with cafes, your brain has learnt which things predict which, right? So I mentioned before in the definition, the learnt. So there's learning involved. So you've got to go to the cafes, you've got to experience good food, good coffee, bad coffee, and your brain starts to learn which things predict which. So in that, you know, half a second or a second as you walk in the cafe, these prior associations are triggering red flags unconsciously and your body's responding, right? Your heart rate's going to go up. If it's negative slightly, you're going to start sweating a bit more. All this happens very quickly and you're feeling it. So we have access to our unconscious through our body's response to it, because our body can respond to the unconscious when we have no idea what's going on.
And faster as well.
And faster, yeah.
And that's because it's a primitive, primal, evolutionary response, right? The amygdala picks up on all of this stuff so that we can actually make really important decisions like better run from this tiger super, super fast without having to pull out the spreadsheet.
It makes sense to err on the side of safety. So I can show you a picture of a scary spider or a snake. I can make that unconscious in the lab.
How do you do that, by the way?
So there's something called binocular rivalry, which is this cool visual illusion I started going back a few years to my PhD. So I can show you a picture in one eye. So if you put up, one of your hands in front of one eye, so one eye is seeing the hand, the other eye is seeing me.
Yeah.
So that's putting your optical system into a conflict. And if you adjust those two things so they're just the right brightness, you'll actually see the hand, then me, then the hand again.
So you manipulate it so the dominant image is what? Some shapes or colours.
Yeah.
And then you introduce a sort of a subliminal image that you're not even conscious of.
In this case, say I can make the hand super bright and shaking and flickering, it becomes very strong and you wouldn't see me anymore.
Mm.
Whatever goes to the other eye gets suppressed outside of awareness.
It's a little bit like that experiment where they say follow how many times on a basketball court, count how many times the ball gets passed on
gorilla,
the red team or whatever, and then nobody notices a gorilla walking across the middle of the court halfway through the game.
Yeah, so that's the power of attention when you're really paying attention to something you don't notice. So that's an extra layer of things on top of that. So you have sort of consciousness manipulations and then attention over the top.
So you use that technique to introduce sort of semi-conscious concepts that our body picks up on, and that's actually playing into intuitive decision making.
Yeah. So we can think that's how we measure it in the lab. So I call it emotional inception, like the Chris Nolan film. He just won, it's just the Oscars the other day. So we can incept information into your brain that you never are aware of, and it can be emotional information, and then we can test and track in the lab how much you can use that unconscious information to improve your decisions, improve your decision confidence and things like that. But if you go back to the cafe, that's all happening in a microsecond as you walk in, right?
Mm.
It's triggering something, your body's responding, you're feeling it, right? There's something, this word interoception, which just means internal perception of the body.
Yep.
So you're feeling it. Maybe it's this heavy sinking feeling of the gut if it's very strong. That's why it's called a gut response. Some people in the fingertips, sweaty palms, chest, different people feel in different parts of the body, but you're tapping into that information with the body. And in an instant, you just feel it. And then you go, maybe not. Let's cross the road and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So it all happens like that.
I've got a question actually while we're on that cafe topic. Years ago, I think I was about 34, and I'd got unwell from this same, sort of set of conditions, and I left a very busy, busy job where, I'd drive to work in the morning, sometimes see people at cafes doing crossword puzzles and just looking really languid and happy. And I was like, right, when I get a moment, I'm going to do that. That was my dream, was to sit in a cafe at an inappropriate time, like 10 in the morning when everyone else is at work, and just have coffee and really thoroughly enjoy myself. Anyway, I got unwell. I got to that spot where I had to pull out of work, and I was finally able to go and do that. And I used to walk down the road and there'd be a bunch of cafes, sort of in this busy area. And I tried to decide which one to go to have this perfect moment. And the cognitive load of having to decide to make what really is something of an intuitive decision, it was too much for me. And I would descend into a panic. And on one occasion I went around the corner and sat in a gutter and hyperventilated and had to just walk back home.
Yeah.
And it was many, many months before I could do it. And I'm not a panic attack type person, but I was certainly going through some terrible anxiety. What's going on there? Because I think I'm probably speaking for maybe many listeners.
Yeah.
Intuition is one of those things where I'm like, yeah, people talk about it. And I often struggle to access it in many ways.
You know,
is there something to be said for being anxious and maybe being a very cerebral thinker that can override your ability to access those intuitive responses in moments like
Absolutely.
That.
So that's the five rules in the book. And the first one is really don't practice, don't even try and practice intuition when you're emotional, when you're stressed, you're anxious, depressed, or if you're in the positive as well. You just won the lottery, just fallen in love and you're like, whoa. Right, you're not going to be able to tap in and feel that bodily sensation. There's all this strong emotion, whatever it is,
that
positive or negative.
Override.
It washes, and you can misattribute. Right. Yeah. So there's in the book I talk about this story of a first date I went on. We went rock climbing in an indoor climbing gym, and it was an amazing experience. You know, I climbed and she climbed and da da da, and it was like 100% chemistry. It was fantastic. Turned out we weren't well suited for each other. And then I kept thinking about it for years. I was like, why did it feel so strong? We just clicked on that first date. And then
it was just heightened.
It turned out she wasn't even into men that much later on, I found. But on that first date, it was amazing. And so it's something called emotional misattribution. And humans are just really bad at understanding where emotions and where feelings come from. And there's actually these famous experiments. They look into this on these where they have people do things on a rickety bridge.
Suspension bridge experiment.
Or the stable bridge. And it's the same kind of the rock climbing on the first date. We were confusing all the adrenaline, the heart rate, the excitement of falling off the wall climbing for that response to each other.
Yeah, wow.
Right? And if you watch carefully, you'll see the producers of, The Bachelor, Bachelorette, these TV shows will use these kind
they
of things
it.
To confuse people because we very easily get confused about what's driving emotions and feelings.
Mm. I wonder if that correlates with I'm a very high adrenaline person.
Yeah.
I go and find trouble, and I talk a lot about how the benefits of living on the edge, I tend to be a little bit of a junkie when it comes to that kind of thing.
What kind of things? Like skydiving? Or you mean
also doing anything that scares me, anything that pushes me. And I get excited by it. I sort of need it. I seek it out. And it serves me in many ways. It lands me in a lot
just
of trouble.
Just physical or in other ways?
Both. Like emotional, psychological, spiritual. Professional. Yeah. And I overextend is probably a way of putting it. But I'm wondering if that also correlates to a sort of a propensity to fall in love too easily. If you're always in that state, can you be confused about...
Yeah, you're easily confused... The feeling for the thing, especially like if you do it, you're skydiving with someone or you go through an intense experience with someone, the feelings for that person and the feelings happening generally will intertwine and mix. And it's hard to know what causes what.
Keep off dating sites, Sarah, is the lesson there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Something you mentioned before, it's called the choice paradox, right?
Yes.
And so humans, we like some choice. We don't like, if we're going to go and buy coffee or buy jam or jam's the classic one they use in experiments.
That was Sheena Iyengar, who has been on the Wild podcast. She initially did that experiment
that Barry Schwartz, who was her
supervisor, then went and co-opted into the theory. But then she went and wrote a book, which is just fascinating, called The Art of Choosing. She's fully blind. She did all these experiments and wrote these complex books fully blind.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Anyway, but yes.
There's like a sweet spot.
Choice.
You don't want to, when you go to the supermarket and you've got to choose an olive oil or something and there's like 20 different things, Like, I don't, like, I start to feel stressed and like annoyed if I've got to turn them and read the label and think the thing, and why is this one? Why is that one twice the price? Is it better? Is it not better? And I was like, oh man, but I don't want to be told, I don't want to have one thing to choose from.
The sweet spot, I think, is six.
Yeah.
That's what our brain can hold, and we still feel like we've got free will, but we're not overwhelmed. I'm opening up a whole can of worms here, aren't I?
Oh, we can get under free will. I've got strong, you know, we don't have free will. As a little side note. But yeah.
All right. We might have to get you back on to discuss that because we need to stay on intuition. So, yeah, look, you touched on the fact that you've covered off things to look out for. So when should we use intuition, when we should not? I think you've got a little bit of a checklist. Do you want to cover off a few more?
Yeah, so I use the acronym SMILE as this sort of how to remember these five rules of how to optimize when it's safe. And people don't like me saying safe to use intuition, but when it's going to be most optimized, like the example I gave, like you just, you know, your fear of getting on the plane, your anxiety around that is not intuition speaking to you about a potential premonition for a plane crash, it's anxiety. So we have to be very careful not to confuse those things.
Yeah.
So the next M in the next letter is for mastery, learning. So I said before, you know, the cafe example, you need to go to enough cafes to build that intuition.
So only use intuition in spaces where you're familiar already. Like don't think that you can just use your intuition to solve a, you know, astrophysical problem.
Yeah.
If you've never played chess, you can't
jump in and be an intuitive chess player. You've got to put the work in. Your brain has to learn these associations unconsciously to pop up these feelings so you can feel, your feelings can guide you, in other words. Yep. So how much learning do you need? That's a little bit more complex. We can get into that if you want. But
people can read your book to find that out.
More emotional things, learn faster, less emotional. So then there's I, right? So for impulses and addiction, and there's some juicy topics here. So what sort of a label of warning that things we're drawn to that are addictive can feel a bit like intuition, right? Drugs, alcohol, social media, gambling, behavioral things. The pull can feel natural. I just need to check that email. I've got to check that post just one more time. And it's my intuition, you know, right? I've got a feeling it's going to go viral. I better just check it, right? You can convince yourself that it's this strong, and it's not intuition. It's similar sort of circuits in the brain, but it's addiction.
Yeah.
Right? And one thing that pops up here is food, right? And there's a movement of intuitive eating, as I'm sure you know.
Yes.
And I'm fairly against that. I think it's a bad idea with modern hyper-engineered foods, right? With billions of dollars going into foods.
Because our bodies can't actually read what we might need intuitively because we're just eating food that's a Molotov cocktail of chemicals
That
are playing at dopamine and the whole thing.
It's that food, modern engineered processed food is shifted more, you know, towards the drug category, which is addictive. Mm. So if you're going to do this simple whole foods diet, then maybe you can do something like intuitive eating. But if you're going to have any processed food, live in the modern world and traveling and doing, you know, it gets very dangerous.
Children, right? I think, can do it if they haven't been introduced to processed
all that
foods.
Stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we try and do that with my kids because they mostly stay off any processed food. But yeah, that's the thing there. And I also separate out the idea of intuition and instinct and impulse to be different things. So instinct being something that is like we're born with, right? With animals have. So baby, you give a baby a lemon, they'll bite into it and their face will screw up. That's an instinct from day one that stays there throughout a whole life. It's hardwired. It doesn't change. Whereas intuition is flexible, dynamic. It will change with learning.
Okay, so we can develop it, we can grow that muscle.
Yeah, instincts, not so much. They're hardwired and we have interesting instincts, you know, to uncertainty we find terrifying, right? And this is a big thing in the modern world. And that's a hardwired instinct through years of evolution, right? All animals, good evidence in pretty much all animals, they don't like uncertainty. They find it uncomfortable. It's like looking at a spider or a snake, it's scary. And comfort is another one. We're hardwired to be drawn towards comfort and push away discomfort. And that brings its own sort of issues in the modern world. And you see this shift, this spin around to people going towards discomfort now with ice baths and saunas and hardcore exercise and all that.
Very tame discomfort, I've got to say.
It's like, controlled discomfort.
Yes, and most of the world is geared towards eliminating as much discomfort as we can.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is an interesting one, isn't it? Because the world is becoming more uncertain, as you say, which means it becomes more difficult to go to your first S in SMILE, a safe environment, predictable and sort of mastered, you know, the M environment, because there's less of those. So making intuitive gut feeling decisions today is, I think it's almost more important than ever before because we're going to have to make faster decisions because there's so many of them coming at us. but it's difficult because the conditions are so uncertain. You know, the playing field has changed.
It is, yeah. So when I talk to people, you know, business leaders and things, that they say they have to use intuition. There's no choice now. They don't have the time luxury, the information. It's always ambiguous, and they've got to make a choice today. And so they will use their intuition. There's still a taboo around that. A lot of them, some of them will come out and talk about it publicly. Most won't still. They're kind of happy to say it in private, but it still has a bit taboo-y, woo-woo-y for the business leader type, which is part of the reason I'm trying to build a science around that to make it legitimate and take away that taboo.
Except Steve Jobs was a big fan of
Absolutely,
intuition,
yeah.
wasn't he? Yeah. But so, I think you've touched on the fact that I'm jumping ahead in your smile thing
yeah,
here.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
I think I read that you've spoken about how he was great with intuition in his business life, but at home he wasn't great. And it reminds me of something that was drawn to my attention a little while back. There's a photo of him in his apartment when he was first starting up Apple, and he's got zero furniture. He's got one lamp and he's sitting on the floor.
Is that cross-legged on the floor, black and white photo? Yeah.
This is so funny because he took 8 years to buy a couch, right, famously. And I think he writes about it in one of the books that came out, one of his biographies. What was hilarious, around that time, I was going through the same thing. I did this experiment to settle down into a real house. And for about 3 years, I didn't have a couch. And there's a photo of me that my sister took doing exactly the same thing. I was sitting on a foam roller on a small little sort of almost entry rug with nothing else on my laptop, which was an Apple at the time. And, you know, we looked at the two photos and went, oh, my goodness. And it took me 3 years. Yet I use my intuition in my professional life as well. So I've interrupted the flow here, but could you actually explain how somebody like Steve and myself can be quite good with making intuitive decisions in our professional life but be shithouse at it in our private life?
Like, absolutely.
I literally can't choose a cafe. I stall when it comes to choosing a toothpaste flavour, but I can actually really get through vast amounts of work through a feel, you know, and I listen to my body as I do that, you know.
So, yeah, it is the E at the end of smile, but it relates back to the M, the mastery. So the type of learning that drives intuition is environmental context specific. So learning you remember that, like, the how to study for exams, right? This idea that when you study in your bedroom at home, you want to make the environment as similar to where the exam room is possible. So you put fragrance on your hand, you chew gum, and then when you go into the exam room, you chew gum and put fragrance, and that helps you access the things you learnt in your bedroom. And there's all these cool studies where people scuba dive and go to the bottom of the ocean and learn new things. And when they come up to the surface, it's harder for them to remember those facts, right?
Because they're not.
It's a different environment,
yeah.
Right? And if you learn it on the surface, it's hard to remember it on the bottom of the ocean.
Interesting.
And so when you're learning something, your brain's actually taking in the whole environment around you. It also takes in your internal state. We'll get to that in a second, like anxiety, stress, if you're drunk or not. So this is important when you think about COVID and things like this, where we had this, a lot of people had finely tuned intuition in the workplace, then all of a sudden shifted to home. And so a lot of the learning of the intuition is attached to the workplace, their office, the people there, and it doesn't translate that well always to a different environment. So Steve Jobs was the example of that, where he wrote about intuition, he spent time in India, he loved it, he talked about using it to guide Apple and product design, and he talked about using it to guide things in his home and his health decisions. And almost everyone in his family says he made some really poor decisions with his health and putting off the cancer treatment until it was basically too late towards the end of his life. And so it's sort of a poignant example of how something can work so well in one area of your life but not another, because you haven't built up that learning, that mastery in that area for health and home and things like that.
Yeah.
So we need to be careful when we're changing contexts and environments.
Yeah.
And when you travel a lot. So I find that I like to run and navigation or, you know, gestures and ways of communicating is another one. When you're in a totally new, different country and different environment, some of those things you take for granted and you use intuition for will be inappropriate. There'll be a mismatch to your new environment. So you've got to be careful in those situations as well.
Mm, that's interesting. Did we cover off the L?
We didn't.
All right. What's the L?
So that's for low probability, but it's really for all things around probabilistic thinking or numbers. So we're just really bad at understanding probabilities. And there's books on this. There's so many psychology experiments showing this, that we just don't get probabilities well, whether it comes to, you know, smoking and sickness or climate change or this or viruses. we just fall prey. We can't feel the numbers in the same way we can other things. So as a general blanket rule, we should just not try to intuit anything around numbers, probabilities, anything with that. Just don't use intuition.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the smile, yeah.
Yeah. So what would be some examples in everyday life? And maybe you could refer to your life, how you use intuition. Because it sounds to me it's really good for things where a checklist, like the spreadsheet, is not appropriate. Yeah. You know, whether to leave a marriage, whether to change jobs. You know, you can do pro and con charts till the cows come home. It won't help you make that decision. So do you do one or the other, or is this nice kind of interplay?
I try and do both, but it does depend on the thing. When it's on the fly, I'll try and lean into intuition. If I'm feeling unwell, if I'm stressed, I haven't slept, or I'm traveling, I'll try and be, or I'm highly emotional. I'll write a list or stay away from it, depending. I'll try and follow those five rules as best I can. When people are faced with large decisions, like you said, buying or selling a house, moving country, or getting married or getting divorced or something, then no matter what they do, the emotions tend to come up. And so they'll start talking about, I just feel this in my gut, or I just feel that. But often that might be the first time they've had to use intuition, because they don't use it for the smaller things. So in the book, I also talk about, if you want to use intuition, practice it with smaller things.
Yes.
So the first time you need to use it is not some life and death or some huge thing. You're used to absorbing the five rules and following, you know, and what it feels like to tap into those subtle feelings inside, and practice that with small decisions, moving to larger and larger ones. So I use it at work. People find this amusing sometimes. I'm a scientist and I run a lab. I use that every, you know, when I'm reading a science paper, trying to understand it, I'll often get an odd feeling early on, and I won't know, like, something's a bit funny about this. Let me just keep, I'll note the feeling. I won't like stop and figure out what it is. I'll just go, okay, it's interesting, and keep on reading. And often that will predict, more so than not, that will predict something's off with the experiment. It's a bad experiment, but I'll get that feeling before I know what's causing it. So my brain, like the cafe, is somehow pulling out red flags in the way they've, maybe the writing, the what they did, where they did it, who knows what. I'm not too worried about all those different variables. So that's an example.
You've got to actually get quite finely tuned to reading your body, to get to sitting with your body.
Yeah.
And I would imagine practices like meditation and mindfulness exercises would also help with this.
So that's the first, that's the S, that's the self-awareness. You need to be sort of tapped into the emotional intelligence, the emotional awareness part of that. And so, if I've just had like four espressos, I'm going to be thrown off. If I'm drunk, I'm going to be thrown off. If I've just been running, I'm probably going to be thrown. So there's a physiology of my body. If it's out of whack, I need to wait for that to calm down. If I'm stressed, if I'm anxious, if I'm feeling down, or I'm highly just won something, it's likewise. I'll just wait to, or I'll do some breathing things, or I'll go for a slow walk. I'll just do something to bring my body back down acutely in the moment.
Yeah, I get asked this a bit, because I know I asked this question when I was younger. It's only as I've got older and over the years I've learned to understand what my body is telling me. But I often get asked this, and I want to ask you the same question, but I'll preface it by saying what happens for me. I often make decisions by seeing things in colour. So if it's in colour, that means it feels good. If I see something in my mind's eye in black and white, it's a no-go zone. I know that there's something going
on
there.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I know actually you have done a fair bit of work on this idea of the mind's eye, haven't you?
Yeah.
And I find that so interesting, because I think I got this right. You've said that some people actually have no capacity to conjure an image in their mind's eye. And I can't imagine what that would be like, because I conjure everything in my mind's eye. I see everything in terms of visuals. I can't remember somebody's name, so I see everything in shapes. If you told me your name was Gary, I would see it as the shape in my head, and I'm likely then to call you Greg because it's the same shape.
The shape of the word.
The shape of the word. So everything is so visual. I can't take anything.
But you don't see the letters, individual letters, or you do?
I do in some cases, but if I'm in a rush, it's the shape. So I'll remember phone numbers and things like that.
But you don't remember the image of someone's face?
Yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do as well. But if I've got to remember the name, it will be and make that correlation. It's the shape and so on. So, yeah, when I'm making decisions and when I'm remembering things, there's a lot of that mind's eye stuff going on.
Yeah, you must have strong imagery then.
Yeah. Is there anything that correlates with intuition or that you can actually say about that? Because as you say, there's people who don't have that capacity.
Yeah, so that's called aphantasia, right? Blind mind's eye. So it's not the general imagination creativity thing. So we're actually doing research into that as well. So the S and the L is probably where it taps in the most. We talked early on about the shark attack thing. And so when you hear about something like sharks or something scary, you tend to imagine it. And we've done experiments looking at this where people read out these sort of scary shark stories or rock climbing stories. And if they have the capacity to visualize, they have that mental imagery, we'll see their skin conductance, their emotional response will go up in this little dark room where they're reading these stories. If they don't have imagery, if they have aphantasia, it pretty much flatlines. Right? And so you can think about that in a number of ways. It probably impacts reading.
It must be so weird for somebody to discover that they don't have that ability, right? Like they've lived their entire life assuming everybody is like them.
Oh, they're shocked. And so I get emails all the time. And so it's kind of like the color blindness thing. They're like, what do you mean you can see something? And often when I give a talk, there'll be always a few people coming out of the audience afterwards, like stunned and confused. And it can be quite traumatic for them. They're like, it's not a metaphor? What do you mean? And I'm like, no, when I think about an apple, I don't see an apple like I'm holding an apple, but I have a conscious experience of what the apple looks like, some colors, or I can add a leaf on there.
It's floating in my brain.
It's floating, but it is conscious, right? So I can see something in my mind's eye, and they're often just shocked and horrified, like they've been colorblind their whole life and they're just realizing, and it changes the way they see the world. And there's a big temptation there to sort of blame, oh, well, the reason I haven't been creative, or the reason I didn't get a promotion, or the reason my relationship didn't work must be because I couldn't visualize, I couldn't imagine.
Does correlate though with low levels of PTSD though, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So imagery, PTSD is, a large part of the diagnosis definition is these uncontrollable traumatic images. So we're doing research into that at the moment as well. And in our lab models of PTSD, it does seem that if you have aphantasia, then you're way less likely to have traumatic memories of a thing.
Be quite protective.
Yeah. Mm. And it relates to empathy, moral decisions, anything you could think that running a simulation in your mind's eye would affect your decision.
Yeah.
Like the shark attack, going swimming in the ocean with sharks, like anything like that, it'll affect your decision making, it'll affect what you do.
Preempting what your behavior might do to somebody.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Risk management. We've done some experiments on that.
So I've taken you off on another tangent,
That's all right.
But
that's
I think it's related.
It is. Mm. So the probability thing, so the shark attack. So for intuition, if you're scared of sharks, that's emotional thinking. It's a great example of how bad we are at understanding what things are likely to hurt us. And sharks are not likely to hurt us, right? Cars are way more likely. Kangaroos, I think, are more likely to hurt us than sharks. But we can't help but imagine it. I remember Jaws and I'm swimming. And if I start imagining a shark and I hear the music, I'm done. I can't relax in the water, right? If you don't have imagery, it's probably not so severe.
Yeah. Are there people who are more intuitive than others? There's this idea that women are far more intuitive. Is it true?
So there's a big individual differences. Some people will use intuition every day, and when we get them into the lab and we test them on our lab objective measure in the lab, those differences show up there as well. Now, we haven't really done the gender, the sex differences yet. There are a lot of questionnaire studies looking at this. And yes, women report using intuition a lot more. They report using what's called emotional and imagical thinking a lot more as well, and that's been linked to that type of thinking. And that's mostly across the board, except for when it comes to gambling and sport. Then all of a sudden men report like this, cross your legs, cross your this and pray this, and then the team's going to win and whatever, all kinds
Pick
of
a piece of grass and
all kinds of all of a sudden it's like magical thinking off the chart for just sports, which is a funny thing. So certain women, in generally speaking, do report using intuition more.
And I imagine there's an evolutionary basis to that. Women have probably been a little bit more tapped into dangers, physical dangers, so they've actually had to play out scenarios in their minds so that they're alive to these kinds of things. So walking down an alleyway, women are probably more likely to feel that they've made an intuitive decision by going, I'm not walking down here, I'll walk down this well-lit street over here. And as it turns out, there was a murder. They find out later that it was a murder down there. Would a man have walked down there potentially? But is it intuition? It's more that women are more geared towards physical safety.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah.
So I hear that a lot from, these kind of scenarios of people walking home late at night and choosing this way versus this way. Yeah. And it's probably better to err on the side of safety. But then you don't want to go too far with that and, not get on the plane because you're feeling anxious or not. If you start falling into that emotional thinking trap, this idea of the emotion's there, therefore the emotion is evidence of something outside in the world, right? Yeah. Like the probability is, therefore I should follow it, and it's not. It's from inside, and we don't want to confuse those two things.
Is there any sort of woo-woo, spiritual, unexplainable, unpoint-attable element to intuition?
I like that, unpoint-attable.
Yeah. That you've come across, because a lot of what your theory is, a lot of what your book's about, a lot of what the work that you do is about finding a neurological explanation for what we feel is a little bit magical, you know, like, oh my God, I can't believe I had a premonition about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's countless examples, and we've all probably had an example of that. And I know that you can sort of probably go back and go, well, that was that cognitive bias playing, that was this going on. In your studies in this area, has there ever been a scenario where you've gone, almost gone, that could actually be magical? I don't know that there's an explanation beyond coincidence,
so,
you know?
So yes and no. So there's some new research I can't talk about yet, which mm-hmm. we're just starting, that is going that direction. And me as a scientist, and most scientists sort of like there's a whole field of what we could call para or ESP or all these different things of people perceiving things via in distance, and I'm fascinated by that as a scientist, right?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, often the research has not done that well. Like, no offense to people doing it, and it's you know, all my colleagues would just laugh and go, "That's just BS. Forget about it," right? But just because we use a scientific method doesn't mean, right? I still use my intuition to choose where to put it, spend our time and energy, and I think of it almost like a venture capitalist, right? And so if there's a 1% chance that there could be something here, then it's worth putting our time and effort into that, because if it is true, it can change everything.
Mm.
And so I have quite a different way of thinking about it. So we can be very conservative with the science we do and the methods we use and do, you know, conservative neuroscience, but we can still be very open-minded to these things because, you know, there's an infinite number of things you could do in science. Replication is good, but there are things with potential high payoff and things with smaller payoff. And so I find it more exciting to go towards some of those things. So stay tuned.
Okay.
We'll maybe come back in a year and talk about some other interesting things.
Yeah.
But I can't quite talk about them yet. But so the answer is yes. But let me throw in the caveat there that often comes up with premonitions. And another way we're terrible at understanding probabilities is it comes to large numbers. What happens with large numbers, right? And so in the book I talk about how, you know, we dream, you know, 5, 6, 7 times a night, and we tend to remember the more emotional dreams. And if you do the numbers of how many people dream, how many dreams there are per night in Australia or in the US, it's a lot of dreams, right? And then you reduce that to the emotional types of dreams, and a lot of people are scared of flying. So, for example, every night there's a lot of people dreaming about plane crashes in some way or another.
And then you get 150 of them showing up to Sydney Airport and getting on a flight one day. There's a high chance that there's going to be a number of them that had a dream about a plane crashing the night before.
So if you run the numbers, every time there's a plane crash or plane incident, then we should absolutely expect a lot of people dreamt about something like that the night before. And that's just the rule of large numbers. And we find that very hard to accept. We like to see patterns in these things. It's called apophonia. But right, if you flip a coin many, many times, you're going to get like 20 heads in a row. And that's, if you do it enough times, you're going to see that a lot, right? But if I just flip 10 in a row, if I just flip 20 heads in a row straight away, you'll be like, oh my God, something like that's meaningful. It shouldn't have happened, but it can happen all the time.
It does.
Yeah, so large numbers can be tricky like that when it comes to premonitions.
And coincidences, I think that can play into things. I mean, I could rattle off some really bizarre things that have happened in my life where I've literally thought a thing, just kind of known, and then like 5 minutes later that person has walked into the room, and there was the chances that it could have happened were like 1 in millions, you know. And I like to have that mystery still dangling there.
Yeah, so I don't want to.
I don't know.
Let me be clear. I'm not saying, you know, we can explain everything that happens with science. We can't. There's way more that we need to try and understand than what we already understand. There's way more unknowns and mysteries, and that's why I find science so exciting. Science is the best thing we know of to get to the truth of something, and these mystical, unexplainable things are where we should be focusing our attention.
Yeah. One final question that sort of speaks to that is, will AI ever develop intuition? Do you think that there could be a robot out there one day who can do intuition?
So the way I define intuition is interesting because it lines up quite well with AI. And so I talk about this in the book, that if you think about it, AI is a learning unconsciously, and they're learning this thing predicts that thing. And so it's kind of, it feels unconscious learning, you know, it feels, if AI is in fact unconscious, and we think it is, it's kind of similar in a sense to intuition. It's making these choices, it's kind of making it blind, it doesn't know why it's making them, but it is making them. So this kind of
But it hasn't parallel. Had the experiences, right?
No, it's done this blind learning off data,
yeah.
And that's human data mainly. So the answer could be yes, if AI stays unconscious, then you can think about it as unconscious learning. Actually, an important caveat that we haven't discussed is bias. And I'm at the AI, because the bias in AI makes me think of this, that importantly, it's good to note that, you know, as with AI and with intuition, if you put junk in, you're going to get junk out. And so if you train your intuition on in a workplace which is wildly out of date, or on, you know, you watch hundreds of movies from the 1950s where all kinds of gender and race things are out of date, you'll absorb that and you'll bring that into your intuition. And so if you train your intuition on, it's like the environment thing, if the environment is out of sync or out of whack with your current environment, it's going to give you bias. And so it is worth keeping that in mind, that you can absolutely have negative bias seep into your intuition.
Yeah. I also sort of think of the somatic element of intuition, right? There's a bodily element to it where we can feel it and we're reading a reaction which is quite primal and is picking up on stuff that we can't do at a conscious level. I just wonder whether AI can ever have that experience, that element to intuition.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, right now, no, right? So the way AI is not built like a human, where it has like a limbic system and we probably don't want AI to be overly emotional and have a limbic system like us. It seems like
we're not going to have a say in that. The tech bros in Silicon Valley will. Yeah, but who's going to police that?
maybe they're working on it, right? So from that point of view, that you can have these emotional things bubble up under the hood of AI. And that's one of the interesting tests I think of AI, is that when you just leave it alone, is it mind wandering? Is it doing something when you don't ask it to do something?
Is it emerging?
Yeah.
Through the complexity that we've inserted into the algorithms. I think that's the scariest aspect of it, because, you know, complexity is complex, and complexity very quickly goes beyond the capacity of the human mind to be able to track it. And I think that's the frightening thing, is that the emergent properties of AI could be such that it might develop something beyond felt experience, you know, something completely different to it, because that's how complexity works. And we're creating something that we just don't know where it'll end up.
Yeah, we don't know how. I mean, I work at a university, right? We don't know, whether it's at schools or university, we don't know what to teach young people now. We don't know, the syllabus is we don't need to keep teaching them the things that we currently are teaching them. Those degrees are out of date already with AI. And so it is this massive problem that's emerging, and mostly schools and universities are putting the blinders on and ignoring it, even though it's rapidly approaching. Like, we've never been faced with this kind of massive reset, right? You know, maybe the Industrial Revolution tasted a bit like this, but
no, but it was spread out over a period of time.
It was slow, and it was, yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of emails and questions on my Substack about this randomly. Students who are saying, you know, what are we going to do about the fact that, you know, university is still considered really important, but at the university experience is such that the curriculum is really behind.
Oh, yeah.
And also the professors and the teachers may even be on top of some of these ideas, but they're not allowed to teach it yet because it hasn't been approved. So the bureaucracy.
It's a massive bureaucracy and change. This is one of the problems with universities. They're large beasts, and there's masses of admin and bureaucracy. And changing a course is hard. Changing a whole degree, orders of magnitude harder. Changing what a university is, it's a massive problem. Yeah.
And what would you advise? Because it's a question I can't answer. It's been a long time since I've been at university, and I'm getting this question coming up a lot. It seems quite strange to me, but it must be significant if it's cropping up so often. What would you advise to young people? Do you go to university? Do you wait a couple of years for an adjustment? I mean, the horse is bolted. I don't know that there ever will be a grand adjustment.
Yeah, I think you still go, because learning how to learn is really important.
Learning how to think.
And there's arguments about knowing the information or having it just, you know, like you got to learn all this stuff so it's in you so you can use it, or just having it, you know, at your fingertips all the time so you can just talk to your AI and it'll tell you. Right. But if you don't know the thing, you can't come up with a solution for this other thing. So having it in you, or just having it someone give it to you when you need it on the spot is very different, because you can't use that to think logically and come up with new ideas. I think learning how to learn, I think going from first principles, thinking on any topic, from poetry to mechanics to computers to whatever, right? And having some basis of that maintained in humanity is important. Mm. Emotional intelligence is important. Creativity is important. A lot of those soft, I'm doing air quotes, soft skills that are not soft, they're very hard skills and they're very hard to measure and understand, are more important now than ever.
I agree. Yeah, it's interesting. But we've almost done a full circle, right?
We have,
From sort of talking about the things that we are now holding dear because they seem to define us, you know, as distinct from the AI that's been created, you know, not under our watch, you know, sort of out of our control. And so maybe, yeah, that's quite a good note to finish on, because I think coming back to those original principles of whether it be love, connecting, creating, and also learning and learning to think, all of those original things that feel intuitively so good, it's interesting that I think they're going to come back around again as really fundamentally important going forward.
Yeah. I mean, what was the – you can – let's say in 20, 30 years we hand over everything like we do with navigation right now, everything to AI, and then let's – I don't know, there's some kind of what's called solar flare – and we, or some nuclear thing, we lose electronics on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what skills do we have? You know, we want to be able to rebuild things and redo things. And if no one's learned to do anything because all our robots and, you know, AIs could do everything for us, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. Actually, this will have to be my last question, but it's a really great one. And I haven't asked it for a while on this podcast, but I used to ask it all the time. What is left if we lose it all? It's kind of a philosophical question that Eric Fromm asked of himself right in the middle of the nuclear, you know, sort of catastrophe in the 1960s. Mm. And, you know, it was a question that he posed. If we did, you know, if the laser flare took everything and took all the data, what is left? You know, what is left? What matters in the final wash up? I ask that of you, I guess, at a personal level. What do you feel would be left for you?
We still have people, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, right. So, yes. I mean, we can still live beautiful lives and have beautiful relationships and live in nature. If we don't have any tech or any machines, then I think we still have everything that we have now, and maybe we're actually happier. Maybe by doing that, you snip off, and the silver lining would be that you solve a lot of the mental health crisis we see at the moment around the globe, because a lot of it is being driven by digital things. So I have a hunch that if you took all that away, maybe not instantly, but probably not, you know, probably in 6 months or something, you'd see a dramatic rebound of positivity. Yeah, I think you'd see a radical shift in the mental health landscape.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Hey, I'm Joel. That was an awesome meandering conversation, and it involved lots of intuition. And I'm sorry I probably took it off in a bunch of different directions, but you provided such interesting answers, so it was worth it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Sarah. It's good fun.
I've got to say, I love having these kinds of conversation at this time in history, primarily because it gets us thinking about what it means to be human, to be truly human. And this question is important, I feel, as we grapple with the largely ill-thought-out inundation of AI into our lives. I know for me, I feel it's becoming super important to be alive to where and how replicas of ourselves become us, where the line lies. And this takes us to, well, what properties go beyond replicable data points? I feel emergent or generalized AI won't ever be able to replicate things like intuition, our felt sense of awe, you know, especially when we're out in nature and having that experience of nature, and those mysterious aspects of creativity, the parts we value precisely because we can't pinpoint where they come from, the parts that are mysterious. I guess I could be thinking this because this is a human limitation, and I'm surmising that AI will also be limited because it is built on our learning and we'll be bound by it as well. The mind boggles, however, to think that AI might actually emerge into or onto a level of complexity we can't, that will then be able to solve the hard problem of consciousness somehow. I've done a few wild conversations over the years with neuroscientists, and one was with Sheena Iyengar, who I mentioned in the conversation about the paradox of choice, and I'll put the link to that in the show notes. The other one that comes to mind was with George Paxinos, who is regarded as the most famous scientist you've never heard of, but he's also the world's leading brain expert. And we talk about whether our brains will ever be good enough, quote unquote, to save the planet. While sifting through all these past episodes, do feel free to rate Wild and share episodes with your friends, as well as download Wild so that you get the latest episodes as they get uploaded. Anyway, please do stay wild, ask the big discerning questions, and I'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.